Hello everybody, it's Luke McBain. Welcome back to the second installment of Leading Into Meaning. I'd like to first give a thank you to one of my new Patreons, which is Hans-Jürgen Walter. Hans-Jürgen Walter has his own business called Vision Into Action, which you can visit on his website, visioninteraction.de. And he has decades of experience in coaching and training, and his areas of expertise are in NLP, in business coaching, and in business moderation. So if you are interested in these kinds of work, please visit his website, have a look, and I'm sure you will find somebody who has tons of experience in that field. And thanks to you, Hans-Jürgen. Welcome on board. Today I'd like to address the question of symbolism. So why using symbols and why using imagery, and where does that come from? Strangely enough, when it comes to corporate communication, public relations, creating a business card, we are all aware that logos and symbols speak to us. They have a certain language, they evoke certain feelings, they have a certain meaning. Now, sometimes we're not even aware what this meaning might be, why they are evoking these emotions, and why are they so important. For writing this book and dealing with certain symbols, it is rather important to use them and to understand them at the same time. Again, I don't believe in any way in occult or esoteric practices. Usually, first of all, I understand nothing about them, to be very honest. I'm not an occultist or in any way involved in, you know, tarot card reading or anything like that. So maybe my remarks are not very qualified. But I already reject that practice in the manifesto, and it has a certain reason. My observation has been that, because people move away from the sense-making within the material world, they move into some esoteric, pseudo-spiritual practice, which I've been involved in myself. I wouldn't call it pseudo-spiritual, perhaps, while I was doing it. Because I was also meditating, sometimes I'm still meditating, and to a certain degree I think it's very, very beneficial. And let me explain why, and then I'll get back to symbolism. Most people, I would argue, still are not aware how their mind functions. I think within popular science, media in general, there is now, you know, proliferated a certain understanding that there is a subconscious, that there are repressed emotions, all these sorts of things. So I think meditation is a good entry point to understand that you have a mind, and that your mind does certain things which you are not necessarily in control of. So if you close your eyes, and you just might want to do that now, just a little experiment, close your eyes. So you're closing your eyes now, I'm closing my eyes, and just focus on your breathing for a moment. So you're breathing through your nose, you feel the breath flowing inward towards your stomach, and you're breathing out again through your nose, and you sort of observe the flow of that in-breath and that out-breath. Okay, so come back now to the here and now, as they say, and open your eyes again. You might want to repeat that a little bit longer, as we did it now, but, I mean, there's a couple of phenomena which you can already observe just by doing that. One is you find your muscles relaxing, especially the facial muscles, but other muscles as well. And so when you come out of that meditation process, you sort of, like, feel refreshed, right? You feel sort of more relaxed, more focused, more centered. And the second thing which you notice is that it's not that easy to keep the attention on the in and out breath. So the mind starts to wander. Plus, some of you might also experience things like images coming up or music or thoughts or memories and not wanting to do this. And I think that's all very normal. It just shows how powerful the mind is, how preoccupied it is with other things, and sort of which, you know, come to the forefront of your attention and demand your attention. And that's also what I read about the book is, you know, how to govern these interests, or actually also to explain that there is some sort of government of interests within the mind, and certain interests want to be heard and demand being satisfied, you know, the most basic of them being food and water. But it could be also other interests. So while you're meditating, all that those interests come to the forefront, and memories and even unpleasurable memories or nice memories. A friend of mine who said, well, I always then start to hear music coming from nowhere. It's like, you know, suddenly my mind has become a radio. So that's so I guess meditation is and yoga is sort of like a good entry point to even start to notice that within your mind, certain dynamics do exist. So back to symbolism. So it's very simple. Okay, so when we talk about corporate communication, business cards, all that stuff, so there's a lot of symbols already there and logos. And of course, they have a certain meaning. They speak to us. And let me give you an example. So, for example, the triangle. Okay, imagine in your mind now a triangle, which is, you know, has a base and it's shaped like a pyramid, so it's like pointing upward and it has a fairly stable image. And sort of like you're imagining this image now in your mind. So, what springs to mind when you look at that image immediately, right? I would assume with most people when they look at the image of the triangle that they have the sense that the base of the triangle is sitting on something. So there's a base, there's a bottom, and there's a top, right? So, of course, and the top being the pointy part of the pyramid. So there's a slight movement also upward because the sides of the pyramid are, or sides of the triangle, sorry, it's not a pyramid. I'm just saying it's a pyramid because it looks like a pyramid, but it's not, it's a triangle. So the sides of the triangle still look sloping upward. So there's even like this sense of something pointing upward, right? Now, these are very basic associations, and you might say, well, what's the whole point of this? Well, the point being is that the triangle per se, as it's now on a piece of paper or in your mind, has no intention, right? It's just a geometrical form, and this geometrical form does not tell you, well, here, I'm sitting with my base on something, on the ground, and actually this tip is of the triangle is pointing upward. Like, it's not saying that, it's not talking to you, it's not written anywhere, but still you have that association with that symbol, with that geometric figure. Another example is the circle, okay? So just imagine a simple circle drawn with a black line on white paper in front of you, okay? So you can imagine that in your mind, look at the circle, and what do you think when you look at a circle, okay? So again, you have that sensation, most likely, that a circle has a center. Okay, so there's somehow a center within that line of the circle, and you have a strong sensation of that there's something inside of that circle, which is sort of like, yeah, either drawing your attention to the center or drawing you into the center. And you might even have the sensation that this line actually only exists because it's revolving or it is drawn around a center. And again, you say, well, listen, I've drawn a lot of circles. I know that what a radius is, and I draw this circle around a center. And that's legitimate. But again, if you look, as if you compare that now to the pyramid, you're not first associating with, well, this circle's sitting on a base, right? And it's pointing upward. You're associating something entirely different with it for whatever reason, whatever memories you have with that. So you already have associations, and it's your interpretation. The circle is not telling you, listen, I have a center. I'm drawn around the center. But it's you, you know, adding that information to that image, which is completely neutral and is not making any statement about any quality it has. You know, it's you as a human being who is invoking those qualities. These are two very simple examples. So when using symbols, they through you know their use and history and over hundreds and hundreds of years, and because of certain geometric qualities they do have, and what we see then in our natural environment, we do associate certain thought patterns with them. Maybe you find that very simple, but I just need to explain that from the bottom up, because some people might not have been involved in symbolism that much. So if you look at it in a very rational way, in a very simple-mannered way, it becomes rather clear, doesn't it? So it's nothing, has nothing to do with any sort of occult practice or drawing a pentagram on a floor. And I reject that completely. I have to repeat it over and over again. And if you're involved in that sort of practice, I think this website is not for you. Because that's not what it's about. It's not about creating symbols and somehow focusing them and thinking that one might attain some sort of level of higher thought. No, that's not it. In the manifesto, I sort of reject social science on one hand, and I reject also esoteric thought on the other hand. And this is a middle way. This is a pathway between those dangers towards thinking when it comes to self-development, but also to leadership. So some of the symbols I'm using are, and I have to be honest there, and maybe this comes also as a disturbance, but I have to mention it sooner or later. They come also usually from the work of Jung, and especially his work in alchemy. Now, for those now who are declined to sort of turn off the podcast and say, oh my God, I don't want to listen to any of this alchemy bullshit. Just, you know, leave me alone with that. I'm not into this. Okay, have a little bit of patience. Listen for the next couple of minutes, and I'll explain some things how I see them, because I'm totally with you, right? I'm totally on your side, and I see absolutely where you're coming from, because that's where I'm coming from myself. So I'm a very big skeptic. And there's two aspects I want to mention here in terms of listening and hearing and reading certain concepts, and then shutting your mind off and rejecting to really engage with them. First of all, I want to address that, and I'll go back to Jung and symbolism. What I've encountered now in the last couple of weeks is a lot of, let's say, framing of concepts. Like, I would present the manifesto in a certain forum, and people would come out with their preconceived notions and interpretations and said, oh, this is something old, this is something stupid, this is something, I already know this, I already know that. And they sort of like present their knowledge on the subject matter. And that's fine. I mean, I'm totally okay if people have knowledge, if they bring their own view and perspective to the table. It just becomes problematic if the other side does not engage with the material, does not read it carefully, and does not really understand what you're writing about. So although I write, for example, in the manifesto, I reject esoteric practices, or we rather reject them because it's more just than one person, then still I get the criticism, oh, this is too esoteric, this whole thing. When I reject social science and people write, oh, why are you always so negative in the manifesto? Why don't you write more about what you want? Then I have to reply, well, because immediately, as soon as I present this idea, you get attacked by the social scientists and you get attacked by the esoteric community. So you get attacked on both sides. That immediately happens. Usually also the what my experience is when presenting it within, you know, forms of leadership institutes, they also immediately reject it and say, well, this is either something old or it doesn't make sense or it's just bullshit. So that's it. So no engagement, no reading, no discussion whatsoever. People already have their, let's say, ideology, their thought patterns. So when something comes along which is outside of that thought pattern, it must be either stupid or it's sort of like within esoteric practices or it's an old thing. Now, it's not an old thing. It's not within esoteric practices, but it's also not within social science. So what is it? Exactly. So to understand what it is, you know, you have to enter a dialogue. And this practice of dialogue, unfortunately, has deteriorated to a great degree. I'm a big fan of dialogue, actually, because in many instances in my life, when I had meaningful dialogue with friends or colleagues, I learned a lot. That was amazing. So this flow of thoughts and feelings back and forth in a dialogue situation is extremely, extremely enriching. But you have to overcome that point where everybody just presents their viewpoints and their opinions and throws their opinions at each other, and then basically nothing much happens afterwards. I'm fine, you know, tunneling my way through that process of, you know, first of those, all those opinions. But after a certain point, you have to then it really go into a dialogue. And most people are not even willing to go to that area where they start dialoguing with you and start to say, okay, so that's, you're saying it's not this, it's saying not that. Well, what is it? And then I'll start explaining it, and then we can, you know, have a discussion. And so that's one point you know, framing certain issues like alchemy, Jung, symbolism. So when people hear symbolism, they say, oh my God, symbolism, no way, I don't want to deal with that. When they hear Jung, oh my God, Jung, no, I don't want, oh, alchemy, oh my God. So very quickly people like put it into like a box and draw a boundary around that and then just discard it. So I guess that's part also of social science. I'm blaming social science for everything, sorry. Because social science has that tendency to conceptually, you know, to make everything into like a mental concept, a mental model. And so to help us basically process a lot of information, right? So when you read something, a scientific paper, or whatever it is, a report or a study, you read the executive summary, which is basically the compartment of the whole idea, and then you decide if you want to continue. So our mind is always already trained very much in this process of creating these boxes to understand reality and social reality especially. So basically, again, on, you know, on the presumption that there is something like empirical science and social science. So that what's happening, and because that is happening, you don't really enter a dialogue anymore. You don't explore anymore what might be different about that certain idea. You just try to grasp it, your mind already tries to get a preconceived notion of what that might be, and if that idea is worth in engaging further or not. And if you pick up certain known words, then you already say, oh, it's within that category, so I don't need to deal with it. I already know that category. And it happens with people, by the way. I'm digressing, but it happens also with people, you will notice. Okay, so people tend to categorize other people and put them into a box. Say, oh, this person is this, this person is that. So she's coming from, I don't know, Eastern Europe, and she's like that. Or he is married to this person and has three children. Or he is, you know, he studied physics and that's why he's like that. So, and why do people do that? Why do they put people into other people into boxes? Because to like lower basically the threat which they could impose through basically who they are. I read that also in the first book that the issue with people, dealing with people, is that people have a mind, and this mind cannot be categorized. Like, you can't put a mind in a box. A mind is always something, is like a black box, in fact. If you want to have a box analogy, it's not a box, but if you want to really go with that, it's a black box. So you don't really know what's inside that mind, and you don't really know what that mind will do in the future. There's no way of knowing that, but we try to do that. Okay, so and for that, we categorize people, we put them in box, then they don't pose a threat to us anymore. We know who they are, basically, and so we can forget about them. And that practice is a very disturbing one, because you're not really engaging with the person in front of you. You're engaging with this box which you have put in your mind about that person, which means you're missing out on all sorts of information when you're dealing with them. In acting, for example, that's the death of acting. Okay, you can't work as an actor if you put people or roles into boxes. The situation is way too complex. You have to be completely free of these concepts to be able to act. And as a leader, I would also recommend not putting people into boxes. That's where you most certainly will fail, make mistakes, and really start to question yourself. So don't do that. Try to deal with the person as the person appears to you in this moment, in this time. And all the necessary information will come up at the time as it is needed. So back to Jung. I'm digressing. I should talk about symbolism. Now I talked about boxes, which is also a symbol. Back to Jung. So when people hear Jung and alchemy, they say, oh, a box. Put it in a box. Throw the box away. Let me deal with something else. But why is alchemy and why is Jung important? And I hope I'll make it back to the symbolism afterwards. I read Jung, I think, 20 years ago. I understood nothing. I thought it was just like a rambling madman. Nothing made sense. Totally mystic. It wasn't even a good novel. Like, it wasn't really even good to read. It was just like pure garble, garble, bubber, bubber. That's what I felt. And to a certain degree, it still is to me today. Like, not all what Jung writes makes immediate sense, but through now my personal experience and my studies of his work, I've gotten some access to his work in a very pragmatic way. So whatever I understand, I understand. If I don't understand it, I don't understand it. And I don't, you know, need to use it. And I'm not a Jungian, and I'm not a fan. I'm not an ideologue. And this leadership theory is not a Jungian leadership theory. See, you're making another box there. So it's just another source of information. That's how I see Jung. And Jung dealt a lot with alchemy. And our notion of alchemy depends where you're coming from. But in general, I would say the notion of alchemy, at least I understood it, somebody who hasn't been exposed to Jung or alchemy, is basically it's all just mumbo jumbo and magic tricks and ignorance and pre-scientific and useless. And thank God for chemistry. So what's mainly taught in schools is, okay, from alchemy, chemistry was developed, and there's a German alchemist who invented porcelain, and he did something useful, and that's that. Well, he didn't invent porcelain, actually, the Chinese did, but he invented it in Germany independently of the Chinese through his own alchemist methods while he was trying to find actually the philosopher's stone and turn lead into gold. Jung argues, and I think I have to agree completely with his assessment, that alchemists weren't actually trying to find gold, or maybe they were, but that this is only part of the solution. So the interaction with the material world, with the chemical world, with the elements, you know, all that burning and watering and I don't know what they did with their flasks and things. I'm not an expert on alchemy, and especially not on the chemical part. Only served or mainly served the psychological process. So he said, if alchemy had no merit, why were they using this for thousands of years? And why did they find beneficial? And I agree also. And when reading alchemical texts now and trying to understand the context of that, you see that the patterns which evolve around that also have to do a lot about mental patterns. So the imagery produced there usually is an expression of what was going on inside of the alchemist while he or she was doing what they were doing. We just talked about symbols a little bit, like the circle and the triangle. And you have to see that in pre-scientific time, all people had to, what they had to go with was basically their own mind. So what was their subjective impression of what they were observing when it comes to chemistry? So they didn't have any empirical methods. And so their own tool was their own mind. And they were observing their own mind while going through these processes. And their own mind was invoking all sorts of fantasies, feelings, imagery, sensations, which they then wrote down in that process. That's why within that process of alchemy, you don't see a lot of unified practice or imagery. Sometimes they are at conflict with each other. There's three phases, there's five phases. There's this image, then this symbol stands for this, then it stands for that. A lot of confusion. So there's no real science of alchemy, I would say. Not so with yoga. For example, in yoga, there's also this like different schools of thoughts, but you will see much more coherence. I would argue perhaps also because maybe alchemy wasn't condoned by the Catholic Church, so it was, you know, done also in secret. And so the community of alchemists didn't really have a chance always to consolidate their knowledge and put it and codify it in one code. But I'm digressing, and I don't know that much about alchemy, but that's what it looks like to me. Having said that, so to focus on a substance or a process and observe your mind is nothing that unusual. I mean, and we just did that in meditation, okay? So you focus on your breath, and while you focus on your breath, your mind does certain things. Basically, that's alchemy. That's the end of the story. You just did it. You're an alchemist. I gotcha. I gotcha. You're an alchemist now. So you focus on something, you focus on an object, you focus on something material, and you observe your mind at the same time. That's meditation. Okay, you can meditate also on a candle. You can meditate on a mandala. You can meditate on the picture of the Dalai Lama. You know, all that is also meditation. You can meditate on something within you, but also outside of you. But the most important thing is that you focus on that which is happening and try to direct your attention towards it. And while you're doing that, you observe your mind. And basically, that's alchemy. So they wrote down all these texts and images sort of explaining what was happening with them while they're going through this alchemical process. And then you get that imagery, which is, well, sometimes disturbing because we don't really have access to that anymore. On the other hand, it invokes certain feelings. So when we look at the imagery, we feel also very strongly about that. Either we reject it or we feel like attracted to that image, but we don't really know why because it's so strange. And I'll just give you an example. In a lot of chemical imagery, you see the sun and the moon at the same time in the sky. Okay, so you might say, well, I sometimes see the moon in the sky while the sun is shining, and maybe that's all it is, and maybe it is. On the other hand, chemical texts talk a lot about the conjunction. Okay, so everything becoming one. So when day and night become one, it's part of the conjunction. And so what is the conjunction? The conjunction is basically becoming one with the self. So to stop this fragmentation of the mind and the conflicting interests and the warring interests for attention and calming the mind down and healing the mind and converging it into one entity, into the self. And again, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a therapist. I might be doing a lot of things wrong here. Right? So all I'm is somebody, you know, using these thoughts for developing better leaders. You always have to think about that in this way, so frame it that way. So, and also that's not something alien to us. You could argue therapy is doing that. We already know that, you know, certain trauma is being basically put into a compartment within the mind, and so it's locked into a certain fragmented piece of the mind, and it's not being allowed to exit from that area because it's too disturbing, like as a memory, as a trauma. Even, you know, when you have personality disorder, I don't know what the official term now is. It used to be multiple personality disorder. I think it's something else now. So that is also an expression of that. So this reunification of the mind is also expressed in alchemical symbols, for example, in the sun and the moon in the sky at the same time. So we look at that and we are somehow weirdly attracted and repelled by that. And I can also argue that through my personal experience, this is happening in my life where the dream world and the waking world are now more in a dialogue than they were before. So this conjunction is already happening at that level. And if you come to that level of, you know, observing your dreams, writing them down on a regular basis, something I recommend to do, then please do so. That might be a good first step. If you're already doing that, that's great. That's very good because it helps you to enter a dialogue, a friendly dialogue within your own mind and see what's happening with your mind, what the interests are of the mind and of the subconscious, which topics are being displayed, which interests. So we covered a little bit of symbolism here. We started off with with a very simple idea of symbolism, looking at triangles and circles. And we went, you know, over a little bit of alchemical symbols and Jung. And just to close that off, I mean, you know, for example, just take the dragon, right, which is, you know, a lot on the website, this dragon which bites his own tail, which is an ancient symbol of chaos, of eternal chaos. And why is the case? Why is that the case? So you could argue, you know, looking back into mythology and the dragon being a very, very old symbol, that perhaps the dragon as a symbol originated from a time where people were sitting at home or in their hut or wherever they were, and outside they heard all sorts of terrible noises outside in the jungle or in the woods, you know, all sorts of animals screeching and making noise. And there's actually this wonderful fairy tale called The Musicians of Bremen, where you have like a donkey, a dog, a cat, and a rooster. So they, you know, all meet each other, and because they have like the saying, because they've all been like kicked out of their homes by their owners as too old, too this, too that. And so they have no place to go. They used to live with the humans, and the humans took care of them. Now they're useless and they've been kicked out. So they meet each other, and on the way they always say, well, something better than death we will find everywhere. And they say they have now a plan. They will go to Bremen, which is a city in Germany, and they will become musicians. So the idea of these four animals, you know, screeching, meowing, barking together to make music, harmonious music, is of course preposterous. It's never going to happen. You know, you always wonder, where do they take the self-confidence for that project? It's just amazing that they believe they can become these famous musicians in Bremen and everybody will love them again. It's endearing. On one hand, it's very endearing because it you know, shows how much they need some sort of attention from humans. But and they want to basically be part of the human society again as musicians, not as animals, because the humans told them as animals, now you're useless, you're old, can't use you anymore. So on many levels already this fable, this fairy tale has a lot of information in it, but I'm coming to the dragon bit, don't worry. So when they at night you know, have to sleep in the woods, they notice a small light in a cabin, and they go to the cabin and they look into the window, and they see within the cabin a group of bandits, of a gang basically, which is feasting and drinking and having fun and listening to music, and it's warm inside. But it's very obvious to them, for whatever reason, that these are bandits, like these are outlaws. They are outside of the, you know, basically outside of the law of humans. They decide to attack them as a group. And they do this by standing, well, first of all, by looking through the window, they stand up on each other's backs and they form like one entity. You could say even in a hierarchy, so the dog stands on the donkey, the cat stands on the dog, and the rooster stands on the cat. And within this formation, basically they crash through the window and make their music, so they screech and they howl and they bark, and they whatever the donkey does, he does. And the bandits, they're so scared, like they're scared of their wits, they like throw down everything and they run away in this panic. And the four animals, well, great, we've got a place to stay, we've got something to eat, we've got something to drink, they've got a place to rest, fantastic. One of the, or some of the bandits, depends, goes back actually at night, says, what was that? What monster was that coming in through that window? I have to go see. So when he goes back in the dark and the cabin, there's no light anymore, he goes in, he stumbles across something, one of the animals, he gets scratched by the cat, the rooster jumps at him, the dog bites him, the donkey kicks him, and he runs out and he says, this is a terrible, terrible monster inside. Never again we should go back. It's like it's a monster from hell. And they never go back. So the four animals, they could keep the house and they stay there and have a good life. And, well, maybe they become musicians in Bremen. Who knows? So, the fairy tale is actually a fairy tale about the dragon, no? It's actually, you could argue, how the dragon and the imagery of the dragon developed. So imagine you sitting in that house at night in the woods, the only safe place which you have. You've closed your doors and you've got a fire going, but you hear all these noises from outside, that screeching and howling and growling and barking and meowing and I don't know what, all sorts of sounds, and you don't know what it is, and your mind just goes nuts, right? Your mind just starts to imagine the most horrible, horrible creature it can imagine. So, and that would be the dragon. The dragon, which is made up of different animals, has different qualities, was invincible, even spouts fire, the most dangerous thing imaginable to a human being at that time. Invincible, can fly, has claws, you know, has serpent-like like scales. So that's where the dragon emanates from. So the most terrible creature one could imagine. And the creature also, which lives in the dark and represents the unknown and chaos and the ultimate destruction. So if you say this is the ultimate destruction and the ultimate chaos, of course it has no boundary, because chaos and the unknown doesn't have a boundary. It's basically everywhere and omnipresent. So that's why the dragon is also biting his tail and is in a circle, because a circle doesn't have, well, it has a boundary, but it doesn't have a beginning and it doesn't have an end. So that was a small lecture on symbolism. Again, have faith, move on, engage with the material. I hope to speak with you soon. I'm a little bit tired, but I hope this time, because yesterday I recorded the same podcast, and when I listened to it, I was very tired. I hope this time I have more energy in my voice. A little bit of coughing there in the middle. Please forgive that. And talk to you soon. Bye-bye.